This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Rebecca Newton started performing for her family at a young age. Singing and dancing was actually her way of keeping peace in a tumultuous household, and it led to a long career in music. For 30 years, she led the Durham-based swing band Rebecca and the High Tones. This year, she stepped out on her own. First solo Americana album, Blue Shirt. And that album is deeply personal. It's a collection full of stories about family and friends. But Rebecca has never been satisfied doing one thing at a time. Beyond music, she's also a prominent player in the tech world, where she works to make games and the internet a safer place for kids. Today, Rebecca Newton is also the president and CEO of Durham's Carolina Theater. Rebecca, welcome back to the State of Things. Nice of you to take an hour out of your schedule. But tell us about your early life, because I think a lot of people certainly know you from the music kingdom. And you were born in Tacoma, Washington.
I was. Tell us
about those early years.
1956. So I was number four in line. And
out of how many?
Four.
All right. Yeah.
So I was baby Becca. That's what they used to call me. And protected and precocious and that sort of thing. And grew up in Tacoma, Seattle. And I went to a French convent. It was called Forest Ridge, and it's now a Jewish day school, I think, which is interesting. I went there to school every day as an Episcopalian.
What was that like for you? Did you know that? I mean, was that a convent? Were you going to the convent school, and you were the kid?
Yeah. Yeah, I was the one kid that couldn't go in the box and talk to the priest about horrible things I'd done. I don't know what kind of horrible things you do at five, but, you know, steal candy from your grandmother's drawer or something. But
Was it a stern and rigid?
Here's what I recall about it. It was really dark. There were pictures of Jesus that with eyes that followed you down these dark hallways with crosses, and it's very stark. You know, there wasn't a lot of, and everybody, of course, all the nuns were wearing black and had glasses and would take you by your ear and things like that. And I just remember incense, you know, and Latin chanting, because it was the 60s, right? So everybody was, you know, Dominus Cubis Cubis. There was like this
Ectum
whole...
Ectum
Spiritu Tuo.
Yeah,
we're showing
off,
aren't we? Yeah, that's all the Latin I know.
Which I always thought was the altar boy's phone number. Call Ectum Spiritu Tuo.
Good.
But it was kind of creepy. Father Worth didn't think that was such a funny joke. Go ahead.
So it was just kind of dark and, you know, but I still feel like I enjoyed it all. I loved the whole idea of like every morning going to this mass and hearing everybody chant. And I have to chant, but I was a little bummed out to watch everybody walk up and get communion. They got the wafer and the grape juice, and then they got to go in the box. Like, I always wanted to go in the box
and see what
it looked like, because I was Episcopalian.
No.
I was not allowed to have communion or to go in the box and see. Like, apparently, I've never even been in one, but apparently, like, there's a screen.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems so mysterious.
You can see the shadows.
Yeah.
And they know who you are. And they
right.
Now they know what you did.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. But do you, so does that, and I mean, so there's music there. Was that music anything?
The chanting was beautiful, I always thought. And I can remember, one time in the sixth grade, I on my way to school when I lived in St. Louis, there was a Catholic church across from my school. And I used to just, in those days, they just left the doors open. And I used to go in there all the time and just sit and like, listen and stuff. So it was sort of like that chanting to me was comforting. But my real introduction to music in Seattle, Tacoma and Seattle, but I think mostly Seattle, was my grandfather was a lighting director for W.C. Fields and Mae West. And so he had all these...
So he worked in Hollywood?
Yeah. And so he had all these reels and stuff. And so we would... I think he used to show these reels, but we watched a lot of like Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, Fred Astaire, all that stuff. And I remember hearing harmony two places. There was a place in Seattle called Steve's Gay 90s, and it was about the 1890s vaudeville type stuff with guys with the straw hats and the striped vests and banjos and, you know, tink, tinky, tinky, tink piano and beatly, beep, beep, beep. And they'd walk around singing these beautiful four-part harmonies. And the same with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor. They were always singing these harmonies, and I fell in love with Gene Kelly. I was five and had this huge crush on him. But I just knew, I just remember having this sort of epiphany at five or four, if you can have such a thing. And I was like, that's what I want to do, you know, so that's where that came from.
Where, what about female artists? Were there any who made you think that you could do this too?
Oh,
you
yeah.
had to be Gene Kelly.
Oh, yeah, Sophie Tucker. So my grandmother bought me a Sophie Tucker record in, when I was four or five, and it was a 78. And it was a live recording of her at some nightclub or something, and I knew all those songs, and I still have that record, and I can't play it anyplace, but it was, you know, it to me it, that was the sort of the pinnacle of like success.
This may not be that record, but this is Sophie Tucker. Let's listen.
I'm just a girl, a wonderful girl. I'm the sweetest one in town. You can search for miles around. Not one like me can be found. I've got a smile, a wonderful smile, and a certain little way. And every time the boys get near me, they look at me and say...
Yeah, but there you go. That is not a kind of a demure crooning, love lost and longing for my boyfriend. She
was in your face. And I sort of love that. I'm kind of a little bit like that, I guess.
Yeah. What did you hang out with your grandparents at all? I mean, in terms of showbiz, did they give you a sense of what that whole industry was like?
Oh, I think by the time I came along, they were well out of that industry. My grandfather was a merchant marine. And, but, you know, there was, my grandmother used to make jokes and say she was a rocket, and I didn't know. I was four or five, and so I totally believed her.
I was like, a rocket. I don't know. Going to the moon?
I knew what the rockets were. But they talked a little bit
about it. So you know about all this, and in fact, I understand that you became kind of a producer at a very early age. You started putting shows together, beginning perhaps with The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, my God. Yeah, when I was eight, I was producer, yeah. I was in Larchmont, New York, and I spent the afternoon, I'm going to put, you can't see me, but I'm making quotes like Dr. Evil, rewriting the Wizard of Oz. So it was probably like a page and a half, and I probably thought it was brilliant. And I went around the neighborhood, and I solicited like parents and kids and everybody, and they all came and met in our, we had a little cul-de-sac in the circle, and they met there, and it all happened, and it all fell apart in about an hour. Yeah. But it was, I just remember thinking, oh, this is awesome. Like, just get a whole bunch of people together and do a show. Like,
put
just
on
like
a show.
Yeah, just like Judy and what's his name?
Mickey Rooney. Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
The infamous. So, and I understand too that you began singing. You were obviously in love with this stuff. You were paying attention to harmonies. You knew what they were, at least, you know, they mattered to you. And you would do this almost as an act of survival around your household. Tell us about that.
Yeah, maybe that's a little strong. But we had. My mother made some poor choices, I guess, and so there were beautiful times when she played the piano when Rodgers and Hammerstein and we sang around the piano, but there were tumultuous, I guess is a good word, times, and things were not pretty, and there was a lot of sort of tension, and I had a lot of anxiety, I think, as a young person, and so I think it was a great way for me to... escape and find all the beauty in the world, right? Because there's so much beauty in art and music and, there's just natural beauty in the world too. But to me, there was something about the frequencies and the harmonics in harmonies, like especially when the Beatles came around, that was like a very big deal. I was in the third grade and their harmonies were so complex. They weren't, but they seemed complex. They were new. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember I can still like sort of feel that those frequencies and what they do to me physically. And so that to me was a way to also keep everybody sort of laughing. You know?
We talk about that. I mean, you didn't go escape to your room
and
sing. You
no.
were you would sort of
no, I'm
launch when the when the tension started. Is that it?
No, I think.
I mean, were you part of it? Was this something you shared with everybody in that moment, or you ran away and sang a song?
No, I think it depended on the situation. I would either retreat because it was the smartest thing to do, or I'd feel it coming or see it. You know, you start to get smart and you sort of say, oh, I know where this is headed. And so I can remember one time in St. Louis, and I had this whole thing was starting to erupt, and we had this volatile person, in our lives. And I just thought, I'm just going to do this whole Judy Garland thing. So I sort of launched into this Judy Garland number, and I said something like, "Hit it, Judy," or something. And the whole, and everybody just sort of, it, everything dissipated, and everybody sort of laughed and thought, okay, this is good, you know. And so it was like a way to dampen those tensions as they would start to rise.
So we started you in Tacoma, we got you to St. Louis, yeah. And we'll bring you to Durham. Rebecca yeah. Newton is my guest, CEO and president of the Carolina Theater in Durham, also a musician and music promoter. Her first solo Americana album released this year called Blue Shirt. We're going to talk about all that and more just ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and here's some music from Rebecca Newton. Rebecca Newton and the High Tones, Truth Be Told.
It's the cure. Stand up for yourself and find your way through the world. Got to have the right attitude if you want to get by. Got to give a little latitude and stop living the lie. To get you some security, start by
This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking to Rebecca Newton today, known around the Triangle for her work as a musician and a music promoter. She's also the president and CEO of Durham's Carolina Theater, and has a parallel career in the tech world. We'll talk all about that. We got you. So we started you in Tacoma, then we got you to St. Louis. What brought you to Durham?
My mom taught medical school over at Duke and came to study with her third and final partner slash husband, common law husband, in biochemistry at Duke.
And so you 69. Got here. How old were you?
I was 13. It was 1969. Now everybody's going to do the math. Oh, no.
We know how old she is. What kind of music were you listening to?
Oh, gosh. Back then, it was, so I had these older brothers who, and one older brother, Ben, who had just a great ear. And so I was turned on to great music at an early age. So The Doors and Led Zeppelin, and then Nashville Skyline came out about 69 or 70. I remember that was like different. And Janis Joplin and Joni Mitchell, and then James Taylor came out. And, so all of that, you know, the Band.
Were you thinking about music as a career at that moment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about that at four.
Wow.
I was like, this is what I'm going to do.
Well, you started writing music pretty early, right?
I did. I was the first song I ever wrote. I was five, but that doesn't count. But it was about the sun and the moon. But seriously, about 13, I started writing music, like songs, actual songs that weren't, you know, about the sun and the moon.
Well, what were they about?
Oh, you know, I don't know how much love you think you can know at 13, but I mm-hmm. thought I did. So there were things about, you know, boyfriends and yeah. that sort of thing.
Yeah. And what about getting on stage? Were you able to get on stage that early?
I did. I had a singing, playing partner named Joffrey Jones, who's now at Berkeley, and he's been there for years and years. We were in the ninth grade together at Rogers Herr in Durham, and he had a 12-string, and I had a 12-string, and we did talent shows. We did James Taylor songs at talent shows.
Oh, man. Can't miss.
And Joni Mitchell and yeah. stuff. So I had it. So 12-string was like my thing for a long time.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool. So you could have been, you went to the convent school.
You're
coming up and you could have been Marianne Faithful. You could have been America's Marianne Faithful. You are. You
okay.
know what?
I'll take
Rebecca
that.
Newton is America's Marianne Faithful.
You guys heard it here.
She's
first.
Here on The State of Things. So you're devoted to music. You've got the talent shows going. School, not so much.
Not so much. No, I wasn't a very good student, I'm afraid. I was here the first year of integration, 1970. It was Hillside. And all the Duke brats, the liberal Duke brats, went to Hillside. And I'm afraid I was so I don't know what the right word is, but I was a mixed up teenager, and school and concentrating was like the very furthest thing from my mind. I was social. Like, to me, the most important thing in my life was like sort of finding family, right? Because I had all these different families. I mean, I had my family, my siblings and stuff, but my mother kept switching up families all the time. It's not funny, but it sort of is in some ways. But, and so I was always trying to sort of create these families, right, out of friends and things like that. And so that, to me, was like the number one goal, was like, gotta get this group of people that are my tribe together, and no matter what, you know, this is what we do, and we hang out and we do this. So school was like, not, they don't do that, right? School, they're like, sit down for 8 hours and just read, or, you know, say yes or no, or answer these questions. It just wasn't very creative.
Yeah. Well, and there is a social dynamic that's associated with school, but it appears it was pretty complicated if those were the first, and you talk about different communities coming together for the first time.
Oh, yes.
It might have been hard to build.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, I think the kids did fine. It was the parents who had the biggest problem. Yeah. We didn't really, none of us really thought about it. And it was cool, because I remember at Hillside, there was so much beautiful singing. There were a lot of men, especially, well, young boys then, I guess, singing out in, they would go into the boys' bathroom, and the windows would always be open, because there wasn't AC back then, which is unbelievable to think about now. But yeah.
And it's a good way to ventilate the cigarette smoke.
Yeah, there was that. We had a smoking corral, actually, where we could legitimately smoke, and I lived there. But I would hear all these beautiful harmonies, so people were singing like "Lean on Me," you know, those beautiful harmonies, and it was, I would hear it just sort of wafting through the smoking corral, but I just loved it. And so that, I could have done that for 8 hours a day easily, right? So,
but your last year, well, last year in high school, you were not.
I was
sitting in class.
I was not. I wasn't a very good student. We've established that. So, my first day of the 12th grade, I quit high school, and I went to my mom's lab at Duke and said, I just can't do this for another year. So a bunch of us had actually quit, and so I drove us all to Durham Community College. It was Durham Tech back then. And in 3 months, we all finished, and we thought, we'd learn more in these 3 months.
So you're organizing the GED crew, all of you who quit school.
That's right.
You see, you know what? We need to get our GED.
Yeah, that's my tribe. Yeah, I had a little VW, and we all smooshed in there. And we went over there, and it was all self-paced, and in 3 months, we were out. And two of those people have been professors for years and years. So, you know, it's I'm not dissing formal education.
You can get a year's worth of education
in 3 months.
Yeah. Parlays into that kind of career in 3 months. You're saying something. So you got some time on your hands. You hitchhiked to New Orleans.
I did hitchhike to New Orleans. What an insane thing that was. I left my car on the side of the road. My mother didn't speak to me for about 8 months after that. And I had $48 in my pocket, which seemed like a lot of money in 1973, and I hitchhiked with two friends, and it took us forever, and we almost got killed, and, you know, all kinds of stuff happened. That's like a whole movie. But and I spent the summer down there, and I met like Blue Oyster Cult, and, you know, I got into all kinds of debauchery. But
were you playing any music, or you just listening?
I would sing and stuff, but and go to these, they had these Sundays in the park, and there was a lot of music in those parks, but I didn't have an instrument or anything. I mean, I didn't have anything. I had like the clothes on my back, and that was it.
Now, given the fact that you quit high school your first day of 12th grade, and you hitchhiked to New Orleans and left your car at the side of the road, I'm going to use the word plan here, but you understand it's in quotes. What was your plan in going to New Orleans?
I had no plan. My plan was to go do music, honestly.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, I'm just going to go down there and be a musician.
Yeah.
17. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, I don't need an instrument or anything. So,
well, they got them down there.
Yeah, they got, yeah, surely there's a guitar in New Orleans. So I went down there, and that plan didn't really happen. But I got back finally, but it was not easy. That was a whole thing. That was a whole thing.
You did get back, and is that when you started RTI?
Oh, no, that was in 83. I had two kids by the time I started RTI.
So what happened then when you got back here?
So I I lived off the grid a couple of times, which was, I loved, and I needed, you know, I loved that. That was like probably one of the happiest times of my life, to be honest. And
well, let me stop you there.
Okay.
Because you established the fact that you need to be social, you need to be connecting people. We've established the fact that when people need help, you're there driving them to tech to get the GED that you caused everybody to lose because you started a movement, quitting school, right? But you're that person, so off the grid feels kind of lonely to me.
Yeah.
Was it, or did you have
I had a partner. Well, the first time there were 10 of us in a commune off Guest Road in Durham on the Eno. That was pretty awesome. Wow. It was awesome in some ways, but it was also hellish. So I was glad to get out of there because that was too many people and everybody, you know, there was one guy who thought he was in charge of us and stuff, and I was blah. So I left there. But then the second time I had, I was living with somebody and it was in Chapel Hill in Chatham County. And he was a great musician and maybe still is and introduced me to Hank Snow and Ry Cooter, and he had a piano. We had nothing, but we had a piano, and I had a guitar. And so we played a lot of music together. And, I mean, it wasn't like I wasn't ever going out, but I just didn't have, we didn't have electricity or anything. And so we had a very, you know, you have to really have your ducks in a row in the winter if you don't have electricity. So I was splitting wood. I was in charge of, like, splitting wood and stuff, and I loved all of that part. And then we'd go to the town hall in Chapel Hill pretty much, like, all the time and listen to music. So I love that. So I still got, I got the best of both worlds.
So all right. But nice. So, and then eventually you did kind of shape up a little bit.
I did. Started behaving. Yeah. So I moved. So after that off-the-grid boyfriend, things went sour, and I moved into from Chatham County off-the-grid into the heart of downtown Durham on Albemarle Street, 205 Albemarle Street, which is a block from the Federal. And it was $65 a month. The house is now on the market for $899,000. It's just insane. But and I started working at the Ivy Room. So again, we had music up there, and that was the first band I was ever in. It was called Mother Country, and it was bluegrass and gospel and that sort of thing, country. And so I lived there for 5 years, and I had my children while I was living down there. And so that's when about 75 is when I went to the my sister, who's been the major catalyst in my life and everything, my tech career, music, everything. She lives in Chapel Hill, and she went up to Tommy Edwards of the Bluegrass Experience on a Thursday night in 75 or 76 and said, my sister can really sing. And they said, okay. And so I just went up there on the stage and sang Stand By Your Men. It's kind of ridiculous when I think about it now. But and people went crazy, and I thought, oh, okay, maybe I can really sing. So that started everything.
So you've got, so the music career is going, but also you talked about being at the Ivy Room and pretty quickly realized that you were a pretty good organizer and innovator. You could kind of shape things up
I did. There was a place upstairs called it was called many things, but at one point it was the No Name Pub, and then it was the Cosmopolitan Tap Room. And I just have a knack for managing things and sort of growing things, right? So I would go across the street. There was a florist. It might even still be there. And I'd get gladiolas for $1 a piece, just out of my own pocket, and put them on every table. And when people would come up, I'd remember them, of course, because I'm social, and I'd say, hey, so-and-so, and I'd have everything that they wanted, like, within 5 minutes. And it was sort of, that was, again, like a family thing. Like, this is, just talking to you is really... made me understand what all that organizing is about. It's about family, right? And so I was creating this family at the Ivy Room, and I was creating, you know, I just create families every place I go. I think that's really the bottom line.
Yeah, I'd almost like to stay here and meditate on this because the idea of organizing, sometimes we think about it in a corporate way, right?
Yeah,
which is, comes from a different place often.
Yeah.
But if you think about it as a network of people and not as a network of finance,
yes.
First of all, you come up with very different answers. Yes. But the skills are very much the same. It's like, how can I use what I know and what I intuit about this group of people to make everybody's lives better?
That's really my that's my thing. It's like finding what people can do and helping them get better, because it helps me get better, right? It's not just about, you know, I'm not all this altruistic, but a little bit.
No, but you're pretty nice most of the time. You get a job then at RTI. Now you start moving into the tech world.
Yeah, so I go to RTI and early days, right, of the internet, and it wasn't even called that, and it was the Department of Defense project that I was working on, And we had something called iPhone, which is now a whole different thing. But I was testing out and beta testing things like Windows and the mouse, both of which I thought, oh, these will never catch on. So what did I know? But
they are horrible.
Oh my God,
but they did catch on.
Yes, they did catch on. But I said they are so slow. Like nobody's ever going to want to do this.
There you go.
And then DOS was so much more efficient, right? Yeah. But no, never mind. So so I got into the tech world through RTI at a very early age of the tech world. And then my sister, once again, the catalyst, came over to my house. She lived across the street and in Durham. And she said, hey, I've got this. They were floppies, I think, back then. And she said, there's this thing called Pipex or it was something like that. And she said, you might really be interested in this. And, oh, my God, I was like, you know, I was like a kid in a candy store. And so then that opened up a whole world. So AOL was really where I got my start in the tech world in a big way.
What were you doing?
So I wore many hats through the 90s there, but my last hat was, I can't even remember my title, but I was in charge of all the guides and hosts and all the volunteers. They were called community leaders. I built a lot of forums and things like that over the years, but did graphic design for them.
Because remember, this is the birth of the chat room.
Yes, that's right. And so I was in charge of all of that, basically. I mean, I had a big group that I worked with, but I started out like sort of as one of those people chatting all the time. And I thought, this is fascinating. I can be with like a gazillion people from around the world all at the same time. It just, to me, it was like the holy grail of life or something. I thought, oh my God, this is where it's all headed. And there was actually an intervention with me, with local musicians that said, what are you doing on this thing, this internet?
Well, what were you doing? What attracted you? Why did you suddenly go crazy when you stuck that floppy in there?
You know, it was one of those epiphanies again. The minute that I got into this chat room and saw that there were people that I didn't know from all over the world talking at the same time, I just knew. I was like, this is where it's all going.
But you recognized there were risks as well.
I did. Over the years, yes, right away, actually, because there was some nefarious, you know, behavior online, there still is. But as a sort of a default of being involved in social, what's now called social networking, they were called communities back then, and I guess they still call them that. But I took on all the kids at AOL. Nobody else was, there was somebody who had them for a long time, and then they just gave them all to me, and there weren't that many back then, and there weren't that many kids online. And I saw that the sociology of the offline world was mirrored in the online world, which I still believe is true. And so where there's people, there's a commodity, right, and currency. And then where there's currency and commodities, there's crime. Where there's crime, you need law enforcement or something like that. And there was no such thing as law enforcement back in those days. So I think it's safe for me to say that I'm one of maybe two or three people in the world who were the earliest, the pioneers of online child safety. Mm. And it was, you know, I would see all the chat logs, right? I mean, I was actually one of the people that was involved in that whole Columbine thing because they had everything online at AOL. So, you know, so I saw a lot of the sort of seedier side.
How were you able to recognize the danger signs in those chats?
Just you could see where they were headed, right? And also because I experienced it myself. So I went into a chat room. Nobody knew anything about who I was, and because you didn't know back then, you didn't know anything. And somebody basically sexually assaulted me in a chat room on AOL, and I thought, wait a minute, what is this? And law enforcement at that, and so I started to see more and more of that happening. And law enforcement at that time in the 90s, they didn't even understand that. They didn't understand it. They would say, well, why don't people just shut down their computer? And that was their answer to it. And so I thought, oh, we've got a big problem here. So we started working on building software to identify this behavior and either get rid of it like right away or deal with the law enforcement. So one thing led to another, and I worked with the FTC and the Parliament in the UK and all around the world, actually, because I started working at a place called Havo, and I was in charge of 24 countries, and we had kids in 24 countries, and I had teams in 24 countries. So I learned a lot during those years, a lot about
Was it, and so you're actually developed, well, first of all, raising awareness that pedophilia is a very serious issue and this online world can make things much more dangerous. Kids are there without, sometimes without supervision.
Right.
And you're developing algorithms that really recognize these things right away.
Right, that's right, based on millions of lines of chat. And to the credit of the people who do the hard work, they're called moderators, they're in there every day looking at, you know, making sure that those kind of things don't happen. But in the early days, they were having to see that. And at Facebook, they still have to see really horrendous things. And not just Facebook, but, you know, Tumblr, and et cetera. And so for me, it was all about two things. It was about making people aware that the online world was about 5% of what happens in the offline world. And people get so not excited in a good way, but they get so
agitated
about the online world, but there it is in their offline world, like right in their faces. So that was something I wanted to bring awareness to.
Rebecca Newton, CEO and president of the Carolina Theater in Durham, but oh, so much more. Also a musician, a music promoter who released her first solo album, and we'll talk about all of that as much as we can in our last segment of the show. Coming up on The State of Things, here's her music now, where she is half of the duo Pinky and Duke. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Rebecca Newton today, an expert in the tech world, prominent face in North Carolina's music scene, president and CEO of the Carolina Theater in Durham, and head of Trust and Community, which is a London-based tech company, part of the London-based company SuperAwesome.com. So let's take you from AOL now to the present and talk about what's being done in terms of this kind of security.
So, you know, it's come a long way, and it's nearly impossible to go to a kid's app or a kid's site and be successful at grooming children. It's because of the great software out there. It's just come a long way. There are still lots of nefarious things happening online, the dark web, et cetera. But there's a lot of people behind the scenes working together to, you know, to do something about all of that. And so I feel like there's a bright future in terms of that, as long as we don't go too far and start embedding chips in people and things like that.
Yeah, that's the problem with security. I mean, you do want to keep everybody safe, but there's always that downside. I want to talk about some of your earlier days before we get to what you're doing right now in terms of music and Carolina Theater and all that. And some of the research you were doing, you worked at RTI, right?
Yeah.
And it was kind of an Agent Orange project, which is a fascinating story.
It was big. So we started that in 85-ish or something. Or something around there, and we did government surveys it was called computer assisted personal interviewing, CAPI, and CATI, computer assisted telephone interviewing. So this was in the '80s, and I was really good at it. I think it's because of my voice. I think I have a sort of androgynous but soothing voice, and plus I was sincerely interested in all of this. So they would throw all the, we called them refusals, like the people that would hang up on people when you had to randomly call people and say, will you talk about your experience in Vietnam? And they were like, no, click. And so they would always give me all the refusals, me and this other guy. And we were very good at it. He sold insurance. He had a good voice too. And not very far into it, and it was a very big project for RTI.
Just to figure out what it is this is all about. What is the Defense Department looking for here?
They're looking to see if there's any link between Agent Orange and health issues.
Yeah.
And it was a very long phone interview, like really long. And you had to keep people on the phone for hours sometimes, depending on the path that they took, right? And so one day, the project manager came in and said, so we're not going to make any calls for a little while. And they just they put it on hold for like 3 to 6 months and paid people not to work, which was just the worst. And now I did other things because I was working for RTI, but we had a whole group of people who had to come in and sit there and not work. And my mom was at NIH. Well, she wasn't at NIH, but she was on panels at NIH. And I was talking to her about it. And she said, that project's never going to continue. They've discovered that there's a link, and they don't want to know. So it was shut down. And it's been so many years that hopefully nobody can sue me for saying this. But so, you know, it was depressing. But at the same time, I just always could extract myself from the emotional stuff and just think, I've got to produce, you know, I've got to get 20 of these or something. I don't know how I could do that.
Well, give me a little, let me ask you to think more about that, because you are listening to these personal stories, many of which might have been horrific. And again, if you're on the phone with somebody for hours, you're starting to get to know them.
Yeah.
Did you start to, you know, put a portrait together? Did you start to have theories about the war, about war itself, about, I mean, anything else?
We all knew. We all knew there was a link, because we were talking to people every day, and they all had the same, they were all saying the same things, and they were people all over the United States, right? And so you knew, and but we felt like it wasn't any of our business or something. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, I mean, where could you go with it? You're doing it.
Yeah.
You're turning over the stuff, and then they have to do it. What about the personal side? The sort of I can imagine, you know, sort of suffering from PTSD yourself, listening to these stories. How'd you manage that?
You know, I don't think I had really quite come to grips with my childhood experiences at that age. I was really detached from all of that, and it wasn't until I was in my 40s that I started to really think about it and think, I'm not ashamed to say this, but I was in therapy from 15 on until a few years ago because of sort of the craziness and the sort of sickness that was in my childhood, but or sick behavior, I should say, that I was exposed to. But I just thought, well, I mean, when you grow up with it, you think, well, this is normal, and this is why kids don't talk about what happens to them, because it's part of your life. Yeah. You're too young to know that that's not okay, right? Even though you do know it's not okay.
Did you start making connections between your experience and their experience, or was that not a...
Did you kept
a nice wall?
I think I kept a nice wall.
Yeah.
I think I did.
Rebecca Newton and the Hightones, when did that happen? How did that come about?
1980-ish, 81. Keith Guile and I had did a gig with a couple of people together at St. Joseph's when I was the executive director there. It's now called the Hayti Heritage or Hayti Cultural Center. And then he said, let's start a band. And I had a swing band in 78 for about a year. And so we put together this band in 81, 82. And we wrote so much music together. We had all this energy. We were in our 20s. And I had two little kids. But my husband at the time was a good, really great musician, still is. And so we got together with people we went to high school with, and then Keith. And there were like 7 or 8 of us. And we did something that was pretty unique at the time. It was very unique to be doing that music. It was Dan Hicks and, you know, Commander Cody and Sam Bush. And I mean, it was like a little bit of everything, new grass and sort of swing grass, or I don't know what we even called it. And we played at Halby's, and we played with the Indigo Girls, and we just did all kinds of interesting stuff. We had all this energy and just wrote. And we rehearsed every Tuesday for like 30 years. It was a sacred. People had kids, you know, got married, everything, but Tuesday nights were sacred. So
yeah, well, and it caught on.
It did.
It was a mishmash, and it's pretty hard to brand in a lot of ways. You call it a swing band, of course.
Yeah.
But why do you think it caught on?
I think because of our energy and because of our harmony, so I'm going to go back to that again. I really think there's something about the frequency of music, and especially in harmonies, that uplifts us, right? And that makes us feel better. And we did happy music. We did not do Cry in Your Beer, The Whole World's Going to Hell in a Handbasket, you know, My Boyfriend Left Me music. We did some, you know, beautiful, slow tunes and stuff. But everything always was ended in a, it was a happy, we were the happy ending Hollywood story of music.
Right? Played with the Indigo Girls, you mentioned
we
that.
We did, in the 80s. That was really great. And they were big on reciprocity. So they would come and play at Halvey's with us, and because we had a big following. And then they'd have us in Atlanta, and down at, they played at the Little Five Points Pub and a place called the White Dot. And so we'd go down there and play with them. And it was really fun. The girls got to, my young girls went with us and they got to hang out with Amy and Emily. And then my ex-husband Bill was on Swampophilia in Nashville. We flew out to Nashville and he was on that record. And it was cool. It was nice.
And you played Montreux.
We did. That was a cool thing. So Ben Palmer was our bass player at the time and had been going over there to sort of play busk and play some. And he sent them a tape, or I don't know if we had CDs by then. I can't remember. And it was 2000, so there were CDs. And so we all went, all seven of us, or there were either seven or eight of us, went over to Montreux and played the Montreux Jazz Festival. And people really loved it. They really loved it because it was very, you know, our stuff was different. I mean, we wrote a lot of our swing / jazz / R&B / bluegrass. We had mandolin, trombone, pedal steel. I mean, it was a, you know, like who does that? So.
Well, but that's, I mean, maybe we can get geeky for a second and I'll drop it if it doesn't work. But the idea of these harmonies, it seems to me like you can write them, right? And there they are. And you can have some, you know, voices that blend. But it seems to me that bringing everything together, it's kind of what the Beatles did. I mean, it was a whole sound.
Well, I'll check that.
with, by the way, did you know Ringo is also left-handed?
I did not know that.
Ringo, so four people in the band, two of them, Paul and Ringo, are left-handed.
Oh, I did not know.
And Ringo will say, part of and he is a great drummer, he may well have been the best musician in the band.
Who knows? I agree.
He's the best musician. But the fact is, you know, you notice there's a little bit of something going on, and he's kind of a little, late.
Yeah.
Right? Well, it's because he had to get his left hand across the kitty. It was a right-handed kid.
Oh.
Anyway, all this to say, it's not just knowing where the notes go and having a nice voice. There's something about the people being together in the room, making that sound right then.
That chemistry, right? So that's a big thing with me, with playing with people. There's a lot of great musicians out there that I necessarily wouldn't be the right person to be playing with them or them with me or whatever. So it is a chemistry thing. Like you can feel it. I can feel that. Yeah. I can totally feel when the chemistry is right and good. And it's great. And then everybody feels it. And people come up and they say, wow, you know, that's moving or something. It took me years to understand that they really feel like that. They weren't just saying that, right?
So why did you wrap it up in 2012, he asked?
With
Rebecca.
It was...
In the high tones.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, well, Bill and I split up in 2010. Very amicably. We'd known each other since the 10th grade. And I think it just felt like it was time. Yeah. We were sort of just moving on, doing different things. I was starting to play with different people. They had started the Duke Street Dogs. They're still playing over there at the Blue Note Grill.
Blue Note.
And it was just time to start doing something different. And I had quit writing music for years. And I mean, I'd written music for plays in the 90s and stuff, but then I just didn't write anything for a long time. And so it was time. That's the best answer.
And you moved on. Did yourself a solo album?
I did.
Well, let's hear a clip from that right now.
Okay.
I just love a man. I love to watch him fly and notice where he lands. And never wonders why. He's sometimes far away. He does the best he can. I just love a man.
I love a man the way I love a dog. Way to go.
I thought that was kind of clever, yeah.
So you got back to writing, clearly.
I did, and just really had a big, big burst. I had a muse land on a friend for a couple of years ago, and it was just like every minute I wanted to do nothing but write music and just be in a room and write music. And so it was timely because I was doing this first solo album, which started out as one thing and ended up completely different. And so now I feel like I can keep writing, and I'm always, you know, sort of paying attention to who's coming in my life. And I have somebody now who's really special to me, who's in my life that I'm starting to write with, and it's been it's very different from any kind of writing I've ever done. So it's great.
So there are more records ahead.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right,
absolutely.
So the music continues.
Yes.
The world, the tech work continues.
Yes.
And now you're the CEO of the Carolina Theater.
Yeah,
in town, which was in trouble when you took it over.
It was. It had just gotten out of trouble.
Yeah.
It had. You know, it had, talk about tumultuous. Whew. And then they had an interim.
There was a debt. It was like $1 million.
It was $1.2 million. Yeah,
yeah. And the city.
Yeah, the city helped, and then Dan Berman came in. He was the executive director for about 18 months and didn't charge the organization, and really helped and turn everything around and worked with the city. And the staff who are still there really stuck through a tough, tough time. And I was a mere donor at the time, so I wasn't in the thick of it. I just knew about it. But anyway, so don't want to really dwell on the past because it's doing so well now. And we have like robust live events and robust film and really smart people. I love working around smart people. I love being around smart people, but I love working with smart people. And that is one smart group of people. It's like the Durham Brain Trust.
It obviously got into that trouble. The city felt it was a treasure needed to be saved. I guess two questions. Why? What's so important about it? And why has it turned around now?
That's a good question. So two good questions. So I always talk about the DNA of the building. So it's about 100 years old. It'll be 100 in 2026. And it's when you stand on that stage and look out, you can sort of feel the history and of all the performances there since 1926. I mean, everybody was there, Katharine Hepburn and, you know, just all kinds of people. And so that is a beautiful, beautiful sight to stand on that stage and look out into that beautiful hall. And so there's so much love and affection for the hall. And it's such an intimate yet sort of grand, it's an oxymoron. It's a big, beautiful, small, intimate hall.
But that's the paradox that probably makes it work. But
yeah. All right. So there's that. And it's right in the heart of downtown Durham. It's stood through everything. And I think I'm just going to give myself a little bit of credit, although I just want to be sure that the city gets credit and the staff and the board of directors, for hanging in there. But I have an energy. I know this about myself now at my age. It took me a long time to get this, but I think I bring an energy that has been very helpful, and people were so excited when I got there. I seriously thought, about 20 people are going to say, hey, that's really cool. It's been 2 years, and people are still stopping me in the hallway or on the street and saying, I am so glad that you're there. And I don't think it's because they think I'm a genius. I think it's because they think, oh, she's local, she's a musician, she gets it, et cetera. Well, it's been a big learning curve. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I didn't just waltz in there and everything, you know, worked out okay. But it's turned around, I think, somewhat because of my positive energy.
Yeah, well, that's the bringing people together.
Yes,
that kind of talent
too.
And that kind of genius, intuitive or cultivated, is one of the things that can make a success wherever you go. Rebecca, thank you.
Yes.
What a pleasure to talk with you. Rebecca Newton, CEO and president of the Carolina Theater Durham, also head of trust and community at the London-based company superawesome.com. And she's got a new solo album, not so new, earlier this year, called Blue Shirt, and there's more on the way. And of course, you can find out everything at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also find out about coming events at the Carolina Theater, all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hull of Mormon. Josie Taras is our intern, Robin Copley is our technical director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.